Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the campaign hustings now, the salvos are flying at Congress and its ruling majority. Democratic challengers are blasting Republicans for giant deficits, for waves of scandal, for vote selling and an ethics vacuum, and for getting nothing done. Off the campaign trail, the criticisms are, if anything, more withering. The GOP's own Dick Armey, former House Majority Leader, says a Republican Congress has lost its way and put winning at all costs ahead of the good of the country. Congressional scholars say the institution of the Congress itself, the people's branch, is in big trouble. Up next on Point, the broken branch of American government and what to do about it. We will hear in this hour from Republican Vin Weber and from a tough battlefront race in Ohio. But joining me now from Washington is Thomas Mann, a longtime Congress watcher and advocate for reform. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. His new book is The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. Thomas Mann, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine and no mean Congress watcher himself. Jack, good to have you.
Excuse me. Hello, Tom's both.
It's taking your breath away, Jack. Thomas Mann, you've been watching Congress for a long time. You're very clear in your book that it's never been just a party of angels in there under Democrats or Republicans. But you're describing something new and clearly deeply unsettling to you and many others going on right now. What's happening with Congress?
You're right, Tom. There never was a golden age of Congress, and certainly the institution has faced tough times before. However, in my 37 years of Congress watching here in D.C., I've never seen quite the dysfunction that it's come to now. What has happened took decades, certainly, to develop. Signs were apparent at the end of the long-term Democratic control of Congress in the 1980s, certainly. But in recent years, Congress has become seized with absolute partisanship, with a belief that ideology and party trump institution, in which the leaders of the House and Senate believe that winning matters above all else at any cost, and they have been prepared to kind of shred the institution, to leave it in tatters. And as a consequence, we don't get the kind of serious legislating, deliberating. We don't get the serious oversight of the executive branch. We get the system manipulated to produce outcomes. Everything's wired in advance. The first branch of government, the linchpin of American democracy, has been relegated to second-class status, and that's had consequences. It means sloppy, ill-advised legislation. It means no looking over the shoulder of the executive branch to anticipate problems, to make mid-course corrections. It has been an appalling situation.
We'll look at sort of point by point as you go down this list, but it seems to me, sadly, here sitting here in 2006, all these years after the framers, we almost have to look back, in your description, at the fundamental role of Congress, what it's supposed to be, and the gap that's opened up between that fully, properly, healthily functioning role and what we actually see on Capitol Hill now. It's a broken branch. What should this branch be doing, and what is that gap that's opened up?
Well, the framers were very clear that they wanted Congress to be the first branch of government. It's Article 1 in the Constitution. Its design took the lion's share of the time at the Constitutional Convention. The sections devoted to the executive and the judiciary are really quite modest in the Constitution. Congress was to represent the people directly. It was to be a human institution that provided this link to the public. It was to be a genuine legislature that is not simply a parliamentary body ratifying decisions made elsewhere, but a transformative legislature, a place where James Madison said elected representatives would come together to refine and enlarge the public view.
And today, go on.
No, I'm sorry. And finally, the third was to really check and balance the other branches, to oversee them, to make sure we didn't have an elected kingship or a judiciary that gets either out of control or whose important independence is threatened.
So today, as you look at it, how far afield, how far short of those constitutional framers' goals for this body?
Sad to say, and this really pains me because I've been a longtime fan of Congress and defended it vigorously over the years from what I thought were ill-advised, uninformed attacks. But I conclude now, along with my co-author, Norman Ornstein, mm-hmm. that Congress falls far short on each of these dimensions. Uncompetitive elections, nonstop fundraising, the permanent campaign, the collapse of the ethics process have all weakened the link between elected representatives and the voters. The legislative process is a joke. Members of Congress spend about 2 days max in Washington. They arrive late Tuesday, no votes before 6 p.m., and they like to be gone by Thursday at noon. And the leadership likes it that way because they don't want members having time to talk to one another because they might absorb new information, change their mind, and upset the well-ordered sequence that the leadership has in mind. There's been a breakdown in the rules and norms by which legislation is handled in the committee and on the floor. It's shocking, Tom, to see the extent to which members are called upon to vote on huge omnibus bills without a clue as to what's actually in them. And then add to that this incredible expansion of earmarks, that is provisions for specific projects for district, states, or companies that are often put in without any kind of serious committee review and whose beneficiaries sometimes aren't known till weeks after the legislation itself has passed. So it's a pretty sorry state. And the final point is just the supineness of this Congress with respect to an executive branch that has been more aggressive and more ambitious in asserting presidential authority than any in my lifetime and perhaps any in the history of our constitutional democracy.
We'll look at the politics of this change. But Jack Beatty, just on the face of it, I mean, here it is, the first branch, Article 1 in the Constitution. Thomas Mann has watched it nearly for a lifetime now, and he says it is fundamentally broken. It's kind of an appalling idea, never mind a reality, in a democracy.
It certainly is, and of course democracy is the only check to it because the institution, as he shows here, can't check itself. For one thing, through gerrymandering and redistricting, the members have essentially picked their own voters. The ethics committee has been substantially emasculated. He tells the story, sordid story, of how Speaker Hastert essentially fired people who would look into Tom DeLay and put on his supine associates. And in fact, the ethics committee that's now investigating Mark Foley has several of its members have received contributions from the speaker and from others. So so that finally the only check is the voter, and of course the voter doesn't know. I mean, for one thing, the voter has a feeling of just they're all corrupt And so what difference does it make? And then also the thing that is hidden and the thing that is in a way most outrageous is the one-to-one connection between campaign money and policy. This is the best Congress money can buy. The people aren't buying it. The drug companies are buying it. The oil companies are buying it. The banking industry is buying it.
Vending machine legislation. You puts in your money and you gets out your bill.
And you gets out your bill, and that is what this Congress is.
There is a lot of campaigning going on over this right now, of course. Midterms coming up. Here's one of the more creative ads in this fall's campaign. Here's Charlie Brown attacking California Republican Congressman John Doolittle.
Rubber stamp.
Have you had enough?
The wiretaps.
If you've had enough, then John Doolittle is out.
Okay, have you had enough? And with the big backbeat. Oh boy, what a picture. Thomas Mann, take us back to 1994. Look back on where the Democrats had come at that point. Things weren't perfect. Then the Republicans came in. What were they promising, and what happened to that promise?
Well, Democrats had shown all too clearly the cost of almost permanent majority status. They were in power 40 years in the House. Mm-hmm. They, near the end, they became arrogant, dismissive of the minority. As the party became more united, they were more willing to cut off any opportunity for meaningful participation by the minority. And Newt Gingrich led a long-term campaign against the culture of corruption of the arrogant Democratic majority, and with that stunning victory in 1994, came in promising to clean up the House and make it begin to operate more according to so-called regular order. They made some changes initially that were modest, but constructive. Certainly, there was a loosening of the leashes on the minority and on rank and file members. But before long, Republicans started realizing that to move the kind of agenda they wanted to move, they had to play hardball with the rules and certainly began doing it. But it really, I think, took force when George Bush came to the White House, because you had the first unified Republican government since the Eisenhower years. You had a very ambitious president in spite of the circumstances of his election, with a polarizing partisan agenda. And what happened is that Speaker Hastert decided his only real responsibility was to be the president's lieutenant, to move legislation through the House in a way that preserved its essential character and put the administration in a good position to deal with the more difficult Senate. That really is what is responsible here, I think, along with this other factor, namely the margins in the House since 1994 have been very narrow. That is, the Republicans mm-hmm. have controlled the House for 12 years, but we're talking about sometimes as few as 6 seats. Now it's 15. This parity means the stakes of every election and seems so high because the majority could change. One never thought that during the Democratic reign. They had huge majorities, and that means the whole legislative process is manipulated to do two things. One, to advance the president's program, and the second is to keep the Republicans in the majority. That, I think, is what's responsible for the for the decline of Congress and its many dysfunctions.
I want to bring our listeners in here, if I may. Terry's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Terry. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi. What do you see, Terry?
I couldn't agree more with your guest.
And where do you point the finger? What's going wrong, Terry?
Bush. I think he's a big monkey wrench in the whole system these days.
But it's Congress we're looking at. Congress is supposed to have its own legs, its own feet, its own way, isn't it?
Well, you know, Bush is theory on his way or no way.
And Congress ready to say a-okay to that, maybe. Terry, thanks for calling. Thomas Mann, I heard just this morning on Morning Edition, NPR, former House Majority Leader Dick Armey kind of saying the same thing. He's a big-time Republican and saying they've put aside words to this effect, that they've put aside the interest of the country for the interest of winning no matter what. I think from the outside looking in, Americans think, well, it's always a free-for-all in there. But you're saying this isn't just the same old, same old. Where? How? Why?
You're absolutely right. It is a free-for-all. Congress isn't supposed to be consensual. It isn't supposed to be without conflict and controversy. It's supposed to be a lively, fighting, debating institution. But what Dick Armey says and what Newt Gingrich says as well is that in its desire to move an ideological agenda, the Congress and its leaders have been willing to defer to an executive, to not ask questions that, frankly, would have helped the president had he been challenged by an aggressive Congress, and been willing to basically trash the institution, to manipulate the processes of the legislature in ways that will give them a short-term advantage, even if it weakens that body. I really think it reflects the fact that we have leaders in both bodies who have no genuine attachment to the institution, who are both leaders in a sense by accident. Hastert elevated by Tom DeLay, Bill Frist selected to replace Trent Lott after a controversy involving Lott, and Frist really put there in many respects by the administration that was looking for someone who would appear to be a good spokesman, but who had no interest in the Senate. In fact, had self-limited himself to two terms. Finally, you had a president who frankly had just disdain and contempt for Congress as an institution, didn't really invest in working with it, expected his lieutenants to deliver for him. He sharpened the partisan ideological divide rather than tried to bridge it, and that reinforced the worst instincts of those in charge on Capitol Hill.
So here you're talking about what you call a broken branch. You describe a decline in disappearance of oversight, tolerance of executive secrecy, decline of deliberation, a collapse of ethical standards. You say the country cannot endure a broken branch for long. If it's broken and it's not working, what does that mean for the country? What happens?
I think we're beginning to see what happens. It has real consequences both for the policy that is enacted, for the ways in which policies are implemented, and for broadly the level of trust and legitimacy in our constitutional system. When the public sees the Congress operating or not operating in this fashion, it loses faith in its very system of governance, but it also suffers the consequences of ill-advised policies not fully vetted in advance. We're facing these from Iraq to a budget situation that's going to spin out of control in a few years. because of increased spending and because of tax cutting over the long haul.
Jack Beatty, do you see the trouble that Thomas Mann describes inside Congress with all the headlines? There have been so many. Do you think it's really come out and bitten the public, got its attention here? Or is the public part of this? I mean, it's not just a polarized Congress. We do have a polarized country politically.
I hear that all the time. I listen to C-SPAN in the morning, every morning. Callers call in from around the country. And what I basically hear is people saying, yeah, that person may be corrupt, but he's our corrupt. You know, it's what someone said about Spinoza. He's our son of a bitch. That partisanship that forgives everything that your side does, while, you know, making everything out of what the other side does, that rancid partisanship, I think, is in the public as well. And then for the rest of the public, there just seems to be indifference. Look at what happened over this year with four members of the House leadership in various stages of criminal, one in jail, several perhaps on their way. Big scandals about earmarking, about lobbying reform, and what happens in a year? Nothing. They turn they can't change the rules about, you know, taking trips on airlines for lobbying. No, we can't touch that. They can't deal with earmarking. Oh no, we can't stop that. I'm sorry. On and on and on. They make no changes as if, well, the public doesn't care about this, so why should we care? And I think that is true about a lot of this stuff. The public, either through this sort of universal cynicism, oh, they're corrupt, there's nothing we can expect, or through just simply nescience, not knowing, these scandals seem to go away. Now, this November, I think, will put some of this to the test. If the public reelects these people, Democrats and Republicans, who have been implicated in some of these scandals, then we're going to know that essentially the ramparts of money and incumbency and redistricting are so high that the public will can't get over them.
Let's get a GOP view of what's going on here. Joining us from Washington is John Vincent Vin Weber, GOP strategist with close ties to the Bush White House, former six-term Minnesota Republican congressman, now a partner at the Washington consulting firm Clock and Weinstock. Vin Weber, thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you. I've been listening a little bit on my way into the office to my friend Tom Mann. Hello, Tom, if you're still there.
Hi, Vin. Happy to have you here.
He's right here with us. Vin Weber, this is a pretty dire diagnosis of what's going on Capitol Hill, of what's happened with the Congress. Thomas Mann is not afraid to throw darts at Democrats, but he says in the last dozen years, Republicans have really taken things off track. Do you agree? Dick Armey was saying something similar this morning. And what's it going to take to get Congress fixed?
I didn't hear Dick, and I have to plead guilty. I'm about a third of the way through The Broken Branch. I apologize. I'd hoped to finish it by this morning, but I haven't. But I'm about a third of the way through it. I more or less agree with Tom and Norm's analysis of what's going on. I might, you know, go a little bit back further into history, as Tom did in his discussion this morning, and point out, as he did, that a lot of this was started by the arrogance of the Democrats at the end of their 40 years of dominance of the House. That's when I was there, and that's still pretty vivid in my mind. But I don't say that to excuse anything that's happened. I mean, you know, we Republicans took over the Congress in 1994, pledging to clean up all sorts of things that we thought had gone awry under the Democrats' arrogant, heavy-handed leadership, and it's hard for me to look at what's happened to the House of Representatives, particularly in the Senate, to a much lesser extent, I think, and say that I'm happy about it. I'm not happy about it. I think that it's reflected in the fact that the Congress's ratings with the public have dipped to all-time lows, and the Republicans are battling for their life in this fall's election.
So here you are, a six-term Republican, saying that. Speak to that public. Should they then be going to the polls to bring about a house cleaning here? Are you saying turn out the majority, or is there any other way to clean this up if it's that bad?
I think that we're going through a traumatizing election right now for the Republicans, and if whatever status they come back in, I think that you'll see a very big change in the way House Republicans operate. I've talked to a lot of the second-tier Republican leaders in the Congress, and there are a lot of good people.
Why should that be true if it's not true before an election, when they're put, you know...
Because elections are the way we do clean things up in Washington. I mean, that's the way democracy works. It'd be nice if everybody always did the right thing all the time.
But even with the majority, you think they'll act differently?
Yeah, I think that they've had a near-death experience, and I think that there'll be substantial changes in attitude. And they've gotten the message, by the way, from their own Republican voters back in their districts. Republicans are at least as angry as their Democrat friends and neighbors are about Foley scandal, about political corruption. As Jack Beatty mentioned, we've had four Republican members of Congress resign in disgrace, and we've covered the waterfront. We have financial scandals, we have political scandals, and we have sex scandals.
It's all there right now in a near-death experience.
But Republicans are angry about this, as they're angry particularly about the spending and earmarking and lack of control of the budget process. So I think one way or the other there's going to be a big change. My only partisan argument would be to say, I don't hear anything much coming out of the Democrats, and I don't observe much from the Democrats, many of whom, as Tom will tell you, are good personal friends of mine, that leads me to believe they will change much if they become the majority.
What a picture. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thomas Mann, Vin Weber says, hey, you can send a Republican majority back, and they've been so scared they're going to change. Do you believe it? Do you buy it?
I actually think they've begun to change a little bit, just as George Bush's popularity has sunk and as signs of an electoral drubbing become more and more apparent. Nonetheless, it seems to me under these circumstances where the Congress has been operating so badly, it's been so dysfunctional, when the public is so unhappy and angry, if under those circumstances, with the narrow majorities we have, you can't change majority party control, then I think all kind of questions would be asked about the rigidity of our democratic system. So I frankly think a necessary, though far from sufficient, condition for changing Congress is to throw the current majority out for a while and put in the other team, and then hold them to the standards they now give voice to.
Joe's calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Wonderful show. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
I think you've already touched on one of my main issues, which, of course, is gerrymandering, which has brought us a lot of candidates that are way more ideological than their constituents because the primaries become the races.
Because they have to appeal to the base and not worry once they've got it.
Exactly. But there are solutions. It's not all doom and gloom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a computer person, and my biggest concern right now is getting through the elections in November with the unverifiable electronic voting machines. I work with a group here in Nashville. We've already found unauthorized software on a Diebold central tabulator in Shelby County, which is Memphis. That's a real problem because that's where the votes are tabulated.
Yeah.
The other issue, so we have
unauthorized software on a central tabulator. That sounds
absolutely
lousy.
Absolutely, and we have a lawsuit pending on that right now. Once we get through this November election, I have no idea what's going to happen. Regardless of the polls, the voting machines control everything. 80% of Americans will vote on electronic machines in November. But then public campaign financing. It's very simple. Candidates are spending 4 days a week at fundraisers. They're beholden to their largest donors. Every piece of legislation that's coming out of Washington is written by a special interest group at this point. So,
yep. Joe, let us pick up. You got some big ones on the table there. Let us pick those up. Thomas Mann, Jack Beatty pointed to this earlier. Campaign financing, there was a lot of talk about it a few years ago. You know, our caller Joe says, if you don't change that, then people are, you know, essentially roundabout buying legislation, sometimes not so roundabout. Does it have to be fixed to fix Congress?
Yes, it does. As Joe suggested also, we've got other problems in the electoral system with gerrymandering and problems with our voting machines and administration. But money in politics is a real problem. And it's become so dominant on Capitol Hill. You know, Tom, the vast majority of members of Congress face no real opposition. The action this time is in about 60, 70 at most congressional districts. The rest are safe. And yet, incumbents from both parties are expected to raise big bucks. They need it if they want to compete for committee chairmanships and party leadership positions. They need it because it is expected that the safe incumbents will send money to the handful of competitive seats. That means everyone's in the business of trying to raise money constantly. They set up their leadership packs so they can get larger contributions. Lobbyists are hit up hard, not just for PAC contributions, but for them to be brokers to raise money. There's so much of a focus on money that it distorts the way in which members spend their time and sets up huge conflicts of interest. It's a big problem, and we need to keep working on it.
Lift that lid on Capitol Hill, says Thomas Mann, and you've got a real can of worms here, unprecedented, really. Jack Beatty, the word that Thomas Mann used before the break was rigidity. That's the one that worries me. I mean, if you trust the American people to watch and change when change is required, you know, even when things go bad, you feel there's a self-righting dynamic here. But if things get too rigid somehow between money or, for heaven's sakes, as our caller Joe says, unauthorized software counting the votes, that kind of rigidity pushes back against the natural sort of exercise of democracy.
That's right. And I think that's one of the propositions at being tested this November. Does that self-corrective mechanism work, or have all these things, money, the machines, gerrymandering, have these things simply put Congress beyond the public will? You know, what you're describing is an oligarchy. This is a form of rule we've seen throughout history where parties serve themselves and serve the special interests, and by various means insulate themselves from public check.
I can imagine a lot of Republicans who aren't rich saying, wait a minute, what do you mean? I'm not part of an oligarchy, but I vote for Republicans. Who are you, Jack Beatty, to tell me it's an oligarchy? It's my party in charge. So what?
Well, yeah, there is that. But, you know, I think a lot of this isn't conservative at all. Our two senators up here are pretty conservative. And they took the stand on the energy bill. They said, we don't think that the government should give subsidies to profit-making businesses.
Your senators, yeah.
Yeah. I thought, well, that makes sense to me. And that was their position on the Medicare drug bill as well. You know, that's not conservative. That's all campaign, corporate finance aimed. It isn't carrying out a conservative ideology. It's just it's an oligarchy serving itself and hoping to wink and, you know, throw a little values gorilla dust in the voters' eyes and get through the next election.
I want to turn out to Columbus, Ohio, if I may, for a moment. And Joe Hallett, he's chief political reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. He's been following the contest there between the Republican incumbent Deborah Price and the Democratic challenger Mary Jo Kilroy. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
We're hearing a big critique of Congress in this hour, and of course it's not just here. The headlines have been bad. How's this filtering out into this one particular race? Do you see voters responding to a charge that Congress is off the rails?
Oh, absolutely. This race probably wouldn't be in play if not for that. I heard you talk about gerrymandering. Even a preponderance of favorably gerrymandered congressional districts here might not be enough to save some of the safest Republicans, including Deborah Price in the 15th congressional district. She's caught in the fallout from the disastrous war, the unpopularity of President Bush, and our governor here, Bob Taft. You know, we've got the scandalous behavior of Bob Ney and Mark Foley and
pleading guilty, Mr. Ney, Congressman Ney, but not resigning yet, amazingly.
Right. So it's cliche, but there really is a perfect storm conspiring on behalf of Democrats and against the Republicans here, and Price has a very strong challenger here in Franklin County Commissioner Mary Jo Kilroy, and she's in a district that is beginning to trend a little bit more Democratic anyway. President Bush and John Kerry almost tied in the district. It was 50-50, and it used to be reliably Republican. And Price has always won with about 60% of the vote.
What's the argument that Deborah Price is making now under these attacks that we heard some of Mary Jo Kilroy's at the top here? How does Deborah Price defend the Congress she's part of when you've got all these scandalous headlines?
Well, she is like a lot of Republicans, trying to distance herself from President Bush. She claims, rightfully so, that she is a moderate Republican. She's a pro-choice Republican. She hasn't got onto the anti-same-sex bandwagon that so many of her cohorts have jumped onto. And she, as indicative of what's happening in a lot of races around the country, is trying to localize this race. She talks a lot about all the bacon she's brought home, and she has brought home a lot of it for hospitals and airports and so forth here. She really almost is helpless to defend herself from some of the charges about some of the wrong track. Country's on the wrong track, and you're part of it, which is exactly what Mary Jo Kilroy is trying to do.
And what do the polls show right now, Joe? Do you have recent numbers?
The polls show that it's just dead even, and in fact that they are trending a little bit against Price,
which no one would have imagined not so long ago, I guess.
No, not at all. She's been a very strong incumbent here, but the fact that she is number four leader in the House has given Kilroy even more ammunition to tie her to the hip of Tom DeLay and a leadership that is floundering in the Foley scandal and in the whole notion that this Congress has taken the country on the wrong path.
High ranking should be an advantage, but maybe not this time. Joe Hallett at the Columbus Dispatch. Joe, thanks very much for joining us.
Happy to be with you.
Let me take a call from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania. Dan's on the line. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hello. I'm proud to be on your program today.
Great to have you. What do you see, Dan? What do you know?
I think that I want to respectfully take Mr. Mann to task for not expressing his views at a sufficient level of alarm. I think we're at a node in history where things could shift very dramatically, and quite simply, we could be at risk of losing our republic. I've seen this since before the last election. We could be on our way to being a banana republic. May I say that as a matter of imagery, we could take the stars out of the field of the Stars and Stripes and put a great big yellow banana there.
We got it. There's a joke, but there's also something very serious there, Thomas Mann. What about it? Here's an American voter who says we could lose our republic here. And you're not alarmed enough, sir, he says.
Well, Dan is maybe the first person who said I'm insufficiently alarmed. Never have I spoken out so aggressively and with such concern as in this book and discussion of it. Listen, I frankly think America, which has long prided itself as the beacon of democracy, the model for constitutional governance around the world, has a lot of explaining to do about every aspect of its democracy and governance. I think there's much cause for concern, but I want to say this. We, as Americans, have a wonderful tendency, which is to not absolve ourselves of shortcomings, to engage in self-criticism, to say, oh my God, this is a mess, let's clean it up. Throughout our history, we've faced challenges like this, and the first step in dealing with it is to acknowledge what's wrong and to get the argument clear and accurate, and then set about doing something about it. That's what this is all about. That's why we wrote the book. That's why there's so much concern around. And on a positive note to Dan, And to Jack, I want to say that I think our system still has enough flexibility in it that an angry, surly public can rise up and throw the rascals out. And by rascals, I'm thinking less of individual members than I'm thinking of the team in charge, because our government has been dominated by a party and not just individual incumbents. And I think that's the first step to beginning to get some change, and then put the fear of God and the new team in power, and then hope some entrepreneurial politicians running for president sense the problems with our political system and begin to make different kind of appeals for a different kind of politics that will begin to diminish somewhat the ideological polarization and the tribal politics that have characterized our public life in recent years, and begin to straighten things out. That's my hope, and frankly, it's my belief.
15 seats required to change control of the House, 6 in the Senate. What are you foreseeing, Tom? I believe I've heard you say as much as a 30-seat change. Do you see a wave out there against the GOP for the Democrats or not?
Oh, I do, and I've seen this wave throughout most of this year. If you had focused on the big macro picture, the indicators of public dissatisfaction with the current team in power and the conditions in the country and Iraq and everything else, you know that we are approaching something akin to a 1994, a 1974 type election. So, and now with the Iraq once again at the forefront of public attention, and the just horrible carnage and lack of progress there, and the Foley scandal having put attention on the way in which the congressional leadership looks first to cover themselves politically instead of being a custodian of their institution, I think it's crystallized the two big issues in this campaign, namely the war in Iraq, and the second is corruption, dysfunction of Congress and the presidency working together. I think now my long-term forecast of 20 to 30 seats pickup for the Dems in the House may look a little modest. It could even go above 30 seats. We're now seeing it show up in the individual races and in the Senate, where the really only potentially 8 Republican seats at risk and 1 Democratic seat. I think the wave is likely to tip all of those races in the same direction and produce a narrow Democratic majority there as well. So I think you're going to see big change in Washington. The key thing, though, is once the voters have managed, in spite of the uncompetitive structure of our elections, have nonetheless managed to produce a change, how will that affect the way in which Congress is run, in which the President and the Congress deal with one another? We've got to hold the new team to high standards, keep their feet to the fire, and
make sure it happens. If there's a new team, Jack Beatty, you know, the GOP says, we've got the machine out there. We're not giving up on this thing. Ken Melman's not. You heard the former president, Bush Sr., say at the top there, it would be awful if Democrats get these committees. Do you see the wave coming, Jack?
Well, I'm when you look at the indicators, even the historical ones, you have to think there is a wave. As I pointed out on Friday, in the 4 congressional elections since the Civil War that have taken place in wartime, the war party has lost an average of 35 seats in the House and 6 seats in the Senate, which would just do it for the Democrats. That's just right through history, from 1862 to 1918 to 1942 to 1966. So that tells you that this is one of the ways America's registered their displeasure with the conduct of wars.
So we will make history one way or another here. Thomas Mann, co-author with Norm Ornstein of The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thomas Mann, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, always great to have you. Thanks for being along.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.